welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Podcast. Today we have a fabulous guest whose film is interesting at this time. We're going to get into that. Eric DePriester's here, his film Treason. We're going to tell you at the end always where it's out. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing? Glad to be here.
I think we have to discuss this film right at the beginning. Where does the onus of the film come from? The writing process, the thought?
Well, I mean, truthfully, before 2016, I was predominantly a comedy writer. I was writing a lot of sitcom pilots. I was writing more kind of broad comedy features. And with Donald Trump's election, my writing just became a lot darker. I was writing more horror. I was just trying to express the darkness I saw in society and the darkness I felt in myself, just consuming all that media, consuming the culture around Trump nonstop. It put me in a dark place, and I wanted to talk about it. I wanted to kind of discuss the cultural phenomenon, and most importantly, I wanted to get out the vote for this election if I could. But I just, the play initially was just, let me just cathartically express all my feelings. Let me just channel my frustration and take his rhetoric and just, you know, put it into art. Because that's, you know, it's when somebody important in my life passes, I write a poem about them. You know, when there's a moral issue that I can't get off my mind, I write a short story. And unfortunately, the Trump administration has been very much on my mind for the past 4 years. And this play, then a movie, was just my way to get it all out.
Hold on. This was a play first?
Yeah, so I wrote it as a play. I was in a playwriting course at UCLA, the Extension School, and I just kind of started messing around with some scenes and then self-produced and directed it as a play for the Hollywood Fringe Festival last June.
So, okay, that's a great starting off point. I'm going to go back to the play. I just want to finish off my first thought. Do you feel better after writing this?
100%. I mean, I don't feel good. I'm not going to feel good until I know it's over, right? There's still this kind of impending doom of like, do I have to move to Mexico or Canada sometime soon? What's going on? So, you know, I'm not going to feel all the way better until there's resolution to this issue. But no, 100%, you know, when you if you're pissed off at your brother and you just haven't expressed that feeling and you just keep it inside of you, it eats away at you. And the same thing with this president, right? I had this anxiety and this frustration and this rage and this, I couldn't understand it. And putting him into a play and then into a movie, I understood him better. I understood my own feelings and I released it all. So I'm still fired up, still trying to get the vote out, all that good stuff. But yeah, it let me kind of take a step back from like the raw visceral quality of those emotions and more just kind of observe it a little bit more.
I guess I have to ask, what did your family feel about reading this script or hearing about it? Or did you let people in after it was filmed?
I mean, you know, my family, I think my mom is actually usually one of the first readers of my script just because, you know, she's been a big reader all my life. She instilled reading in me. So she always loves to read. I can't say that she has the most critical takes. Like she doesn't give me the, you know, she's got great taste, but I'm her son, you know, she's not going to give me the real hard punches. But no, I mean, they saw multiple showings of the play. I think my mom, at least, I think probably my brother too, read the script before we went out and shot it. Yeah, they've been very involved in the whole process, but my whole family is very politically involved, right? Like my brother is, like we were both on the debate team and we both kind of studied political science and philosophy in college. And from a young age, my parents have, you know, my dad's been conservative most of my life, voted for Clinton, thankfully, and he's voting for Biden now. So, you know, he's a sensible man at the very least. But, you know, it was a part of growing up where we had these dinner table arguments of, you know, here's my dad's stance on Reagan. Here's me and my brother's take informed by our a little bit more liberal history teacher's take. And we've always been politically engaged and discussed the importance of staying involved and voicing your opinion and all that good stuff. So you know, when I started doing this this project, I think everybody was like, all right, cool, let's express that opinion and hopefully affect some change if we can.
We haven't even gotten your film yet, but I want to go back to the play issue. When you were doing this play, was the film always going to come out of it, or that just sort of, nope, I need a film after you were done?
I honestly took it one step at a time, right? Because like I finished a first draft of the play in November, and then in February, I was like, all right, I guess I'm just going to produce it myself. And then by June, we had it up and running. So there was no consideration of like, what's the long-term prospect of this? It was just, I wrote a thing, I think it's good, but I don't know how to get it produced, so I'll produce it myself. And then, you know, everything was just do the play, right? Get the cast assembled, design all the props, figure out how to direct, do all that kind of stuff. So I never even thought what the next iteration of the project would be until I was about halfway through the performances. And then you start meeting all these people at Hollywood Fringe Festival. It's a big communal, everybody's kind of critiquing each other's work and talking about what other projects you have lined up. And there's just a series of conversations curbside after a showing where people are like, so what's next? This could be a movie, right? It's all single location right now. And we added some locations to the movie, but in the play, it all took place within the house. So I had the cast. It seemed like a fairly, you know, reasonable production, right? I wasn't trying to make a post-apocalyptic movie myself. So it seemed at least approachable. But honestly, the biggest thing was I was super proud of it. We had 7 showings and it was fantastic. And I was a 36-seat theater. And I want to say we sold like 85% of the tickets. So we had great attendance, but still 36 seats, 85%, 7 showings, you know, that's, we're talking a couple hundred people maybe, and then it's done. It's so ephemeral. And, you know, that's the beauty of theater, right? That it's there and then it's gone. But there's something dissatisfying about that where I wanted it to last. Like I wanted a version to show my buddy in Boston, and I wanted a version that I could show somebody in 10 years. And, you know, before COVID hit, I wanted a version that we could tour around swing states prior to the election, hold a series of screenings and Q&As and just kind of like pop up in Iowa and let's set up camp and, you know, run some Biden campaign kind of stuff. So unfortunately we haven't been able to do that this year, but yeah, just kind of kept snowballing and I was having fun and learning a lot and I had good people with me. So I just kind of, yeah, kept riding the wave.
So COVID killed your dream. I hate to say that, but it really sounds like, I mean, you sound passionate about your film, about your politics, and that does come through in the film. I'm not going to say either way which way I'm going, but that's not my choice. But I feel bad for you after watching this film and hearing you going, yeah, I could see exactly where you're going in this to do that. So did you think of taking your film then and sending it to Iowa and maybe doing a Zoom debate or something?
You know, I honestly just don't know how to get it out. Like I was trying to get it out to the different Democratic Party, like smaller clubs or smaller, like the state chapters. And I honestly just haven't gotten a lot of response. So I'd love to try to be more connected with the Democratic campaigns and do more political events. And, you know, we've tried to line up some screens through my distributor, but I think what's working against me right now is we didn't do any virtual festivals. I kind of figured because it was all virtual, it didn't really matter. But you know, the fact is if even a virtual festival is going to get some attention, you're going to get some press, you just get momentum from that. So between not having any festival momentum and not having any stars of any real note, it's been uphill battle to try to just get on people's radar. So, you know, I'd love to just engage in any sort of political conversation like that and just keep getting the word out. But, yeah, it just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. I shouldn't come up, I guess, now. Virtual festivals, just so everybody knows listening, will help you immensely because people like me will notice them and other reviewers would notice them. So any indie filmmaker out there, if you're listening to this, please put it in virtual festivals because do your Twitter work, do your Facebook work, and what you have, it does help us to see them. So now let's finally get into your film. We've done the play. We're finally getting into the heart of the film. Where did you film this? Like, where did the house location come from?
So it's about 3 hours from Los Angeles. Joshua Tree National Park is right there.
And oh, wow.
Maybe like 20 minutes, half an hour from Joshua Tree is an even smaller town called 29 Palms. And it's just kind of, you know, there's a couple restaurants, there's, you know, a bar or a couple bars. There's really not much there, but it's just kind of just the perfect, beautiful, but spooky desert town. So we rented one house there that was the primary filming location. And I want to say like 2/3 of the cast and crew were staying at that house. And then we had a secondary house that mostly the cast were staying at. So we could let them get some, you know, good night rest. So they were camera ready. But yeah, it was, I think we shot for 11 days and, it was kind of just like summer camp, you know, you'd wake up and everybody was already there and, pitching in, and definitely a lot of long, crazy days, but, mostly very fun.
How different was shooting the film and blocking the film as opposed to blocking a play? Because, I mean, you got a lot more to work with in the film. You got more room, obviously more locations. So how was that as a director to do?
Well, I would say that, I mean, it's just the you know, the short answer is just there's way more options, right? You can film from a bunch of different angles. You can play with the lighting. You can... you know, you can do a million different things on film that you can't do with a play. A play has to be very presentational, right? Every action has to be much broader. Every bit of dialogue has to just be a little more overpronounced, a little bit more dramatic in delivery. And, you know, I think if I'd gotten onto set and I'd had that complete, just, you know, table full of options, just a spread of, I can do anything I want with this scene, and I had no idea what to do, and I also had a crew that was just kind of just sitting there waiting, I could see that that might have been a little anxiety-inducing, just like, oh, what do I do now? There's so many options. But, you know, I over-prepared. Like, I drew out very, very terrible storyboards and read every single thing I could find about directing and just watched a million movies. And so I felt very comfortable with exactly what I might want to do going into each scene. And then honestly, my two DPs were just a fantastic pair. One, Julia Weisberg, is a little more inexperienced, but has this beautiful poetic eye. Like she loves Terrence Malick. So most of the inserts were just like a nice landscape shot or just kind of this weird angle, just impressionistic. That's most of her work. Uh-huh. And then the other DP, Fernando Cordero Caballero, is very experienced. He's done a ton of music videos, done a bunch of short films and features. And, you know, they just, between my storyboards and their two very different perspectives, there was just always a visual idea. So every time we started blocking out the actors, yeah, there was a lot of options and that could be a little anxiety inducing, but I just felt great about it. It was, you know, I felt like we always chose the best option, or at least the most interesting option. And just, it was very freeing. It was, and, you know, frankly, a lot more fun because I could kind of lean on more collaborators and, it was less personal stress. I could kind of share the load a little bit more.
I want to discuss your lighting. It looked like you had a very definite technique when you were lighting inside the house. Like when you take the scenes out of the place, which I will get to later, I noticed your lighting was very specific. It wasn't too bright. It wasn't too thick. It was like almost like sunrise all the time, but sunrise hadn't quite showed up yet. Was that your plan? Yeah. Like, because the end of the film is bright at the very end. So was that conscientious?
We definitely wanted to be naturalistic, right? We didn't want like big, and you know, you can see that in the sets too, right? We didn't want something that's very obviously produced, almost have this like documentary type quality to some of it. So it's just very, very naturalistic. But I think actually one of the DPs, Fernando, was also the lighting designer, and he just kind of has this taste for a little bit softer. And frankly, I've never seen a fog machine on a set before. I haven't been on many sets. That's not saying much, but it kind of boggled my mind that he was fogging up almost every single shot. just to kind of catch that light, to get that kind of sunset type quality. And there were scenes where I remember standing there on set, like, I don't understand what he's doing. He's great. So I'm taking his word for it, but I'm not sure why we're smoking this scene, but it really captures the light, and you just kind of get those little, glimmers, and yeah, just kind of this, like sunset magic hour kind of quality to everything.
So let's move off to the bar then from here. Cause I find the bar was very lightly lit. Like, it seemed like a place I would go visit. It was very bright. What I'm trying to say, it was a ray of hope in the film that everybody came together at the bar. Everybody talked about their issues at the bar. It wasn't one-sided like at the house.
Well, and frankly, the biggest contrast we wanted in lighting is we wanted, every time you were inside the house, I wanted it to be suffocated, right?
Yes,
I wanted
it
to be, you were trapped. There's a claustrophobic sense where it's just kind of damp and just like just stale air, and you feel trapped with this family. So, you know, when you were out on the landscape, I just wanted a bright, wide open, beautiful Western landscapes, right? When you go to the church, when you go to the bar, I wanted it to be, this is civilization, right? This is your way out. This is, if you choose to escape the situation that you found yourself in, the way you do it is you go to the bar, you go to the church, you go outside, you find your community, you find your world outside of this claustrophobic nightmare.
Okay, so I'm reading this film right, so I'm doing well. Okay, great. How was getting the bar and getting the church? Were there any issues in getting those locations?
The bar was actually crazy easy. The same landowner that rented us the house also had the bar and was also renting us the secondary actor's house. So I just signed her one check, no problem there. And the church, I had the perfect church lined up. It was closer to the houses we were staying at. It was smaller. It was more in the middle of the desert. It almost looked like something from like a Sergio Leone movie. It was perfect. And that congregation decided they didn't want to have an R-rated movie film on the premise. So, you know, I totally understand that. We ended up finding this other church in town. I mean, there's like something like 20 churches right nearby with some crazy amount. So we had some selection, but, my producer walked to the church, and I don't think we didn't have to pay them anything. We just kind of told them what this was about, and, you know, made sure that the pastor was coming off in a, you know, a positive light. He was a good influence in the scene, and they're totally cool with it.
I do want to go back to the bar for one. Liberty Lager Beer. I'm pretty sure you made the label, but I don't know. Did you make those labels?
Yep, sure did.
So how was designing a beer label? And did you think about ever making it?
Well, it's funny. One of my close friends from high school is a brewer. So we've talked about like, hey, what if we put together this Liberty Lager at some point? That was one of the things I had the most fun with. Like, you know, we were a small indie production, and as the person fronting a lot of the money, every chance I could have to do a job myself was just, you know, that's cutting costs. So I'm not saying that I want to be a production designer long term, but I had a whole lot of fun doing a lot of that production design. Like the beer label was just like, you know, what's a funny name that's kind of an ironic dig at this guy's whole lifestyle and approach, and something also nice and Americana. So, you know, Liberty Lager, and, you know, all the contracts and the treaties that are framed in his office have distinct language and like historical names. And I printing the money with Emperor Norton on the face instead of a president. And I had a lot of fun, you know, because I really appreciate it when a show like A Good Place or Parks and Recreation, especially, like I see the Mike Schur shows really do this. They just, every little detail is something significant or silly or an inside joke. It's just, you know, if you're going to have a beer bottle there, why not have fun with it?
I'm with you. Now, so you production designed the flag then that sits outside on the pole?
Yep, I mocked that up and then printed it out, and my mom actually sewed the crest onto the flag.
Oh, that's awesome. I guess the one thing I wanted to ask, did anybody ask about the flag, or they did ever send a word to you about it? Like neighbors or anything, or there's just not enough people to care?
I mean, we were filming. We were way out there. Like, okay. You know, I'd step away from the house and it was just darkness all around.
Okay.
So I'm sure that there's some neighbors that saw us at some point, but nobody that ever really said anything about the, actually, I can't remember a single comment about the flag. I remember telling people at Fringe Festival that it was the Polish flag, but upside down and a different crest on it. Nobody was ever like, what is that crazy thing you're flying?
The toy planes, I presumed you got off eBay.
Yep.
His daughter doesn't like them very much, but that's okay. The Risk game, I thought it was just the perfect thing. I was trying to think of another game you could use, but I could not think of anything. So was Risk involved in the play too, or just in the movie?
Yeah. I definitely wrote a scene of them playing Risk like in the very first draft. Like this is always, it's always been a part of it. I don't know. It seemed like the perfect representation of the kind of power struggle and, you know, the whole dynamic between the family. And also I just have a huge personal history with Risk. You know, my family played it growing up. We've played it with the neighbor kids in like middle school. And then in college, we'd, you know, get a little silly and play Risk for 5 hours. And just, it's always been a game that's been you know, just part of my life. So it was very natural to just place that in there.
I want to get into your lead character and his wife's relationship. I don't know how to say it. She seems happy, but doesn't seem happy. You're kind of always trying to convince the viewer. I couldn't decide at any time whether like she wanted to be there or didn't want to. I couldn't make up my mind. Should I have made it up at some point or no?
I think what I was trying to do with their relationship in particular is I was trying to basically without, you know, I didn't want to show a black eye or make it too obvious or really extreme verbal abuse, but you know, that's a pretty typical domestic abuse relationship, right?
That's where, what I was taking. I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. She sees the strength and she sees why he's a negative influence. She sees why she should leave. She knows she should leave on some logical level, but you know, she still loves him and she's scared of him. And it's this whole, I think there are moments of genuine contentment where she does something kind of sweet and disarming and reminds her of when they first met or what she still loves about him. Or she sees him kind of father Kyle in a reasonable way. And like, well, there is some of the man that I still love in there, but, you know, he's also just kind of become a monster. So, that was honestly the hardest character for me to write, the mother, because it's a very complicated mindset. And fortunately it's not a situation I've been in where I've been in an abusive relationship like that. I've witnessed some, but, it was very hard to find that balance of how much to show and exactly, you know, how in she is and how ready she is to leave.
Yeah, I really feel your main male lead is defined. The son's defined. The daughter's defined. And even the priest, I'm not sure you knew how to write a few times. I wasn't sure where he was coming from at times. I'm kind of like, I think he's even uncomfortable being in the situation he's in. As a pastor, I felt he needed to go. But I don't know if he was comfortable there ever. I never felt he was. I felt he was just trying to disarm the situation to help the wife. I don't think he really wanted him to come to church.
Well, and truthfully, I think that is also an expression of kind of how I feel about religion in my own life. You know, I feel like it's a good attempt. Like I'm not going to admonish anyone's beliefs. I happen to be a-religious. I don't think God does not exist. I just don't think about God. So I kind of see religion as an empty gesture. Now that's putting it very strong. I don't mean that. Like, obviously believe what you want to believe, but I see the priest's attempt to resolve the situation as an empty gesture where it's like, he's not really going to do anything. There's not really anything of substance that's going to happen in this interaction. He's just kind of going through the motions. He's going to try. And, you know, that's the type of person that a woman in her situation would turn to in that. But yeah, you know, to be totally fair to the pastor, I probably could have made him a little bit, more proactive or more humanized or, but yeah, I mean, like I said, I was a philosophy major. So I always kind of keep religion at a distance and, maybe that's something I need to work on.
No problem. Does the whole town hate these people? Like, we do see a scene with Kyle and Savannah that they're kind of picked on by the town people. But I don't know if the whole town, because when I think it's Grant, the lead, goes to the bar, people seem to like him at the bar or put up with him.
I think it varies character by character, right? I think Grant is like, there's a couple militia members in town that probably actively support him and are like, yeah, you know, speak that truth to power. And I think most of the town just thinks he's a big old joke and they kind of, you know, he's the buffoon, right? You poke him with a stick enough times and he's going to do something big and silly and dramatic. I think they're probably scared of the son, as you know, everybody should be. I think the daughter's probably the one with the best town reputation, right? She's cute. She's fairly normal. She's just kind of the girl next door, even though she's associated with those crazy people. And I think the wife is probably, just people feel sad for her more than they actively dislike her. Or, you know, I bet, you know, when she goes to the market, people kind of give her some, you know, maybe they're looking at her a little too closely to try to overanalyze her. But I think it's all coming from a place of concern. Whereas when Grant goes to the market, it's look at this dummy, you know.
I totally get where you're coming at. How was casting? Since you said you had the play cast and then took the play people and brought them to a film, how was casting for the play then?
So for the play, the only change over in the play from the play to the movie was the original Grant. So
hold on, you changed your lead?
Yes.
Oh wait, we got to get into that.
Truthfully, it comes down to just presence more than anything, right? So the lead we had in the play, he's a man of smaller stature, right? So we were kind of playing with Grant is kind of this Napoleonic complex, right? He's not intimidating at all, so he's all bluster. It's more of a direct expression of Trump's spirit rather than an embodiment of his actual presence. And I think that worked on a play because you need these big, dramatic, over-exaggerated lines and gestures. But truthfully, I think if we'd filmed that, it would have read way too broad. And, perhaps we could have felt out that difference a little bit more with the original actor. But honestly, the Jeff LeBeau, who's playing Grant in the movie, is just, he's perfect. Like as soon as I saw him in another play that the wife was in, she introduced us. And as soon as I saw him, I was just like, this man has the presence. He has the energy, and he has this kind of weird, raw, magnetic charisma. That's, you know, I don't want to overreach comparing him to Jack Nicholson, because obviously that's a crazy statement, but there's some sort of like manic quality in his eyes sometimes where you're kind of scared of him. He might do anything at any moment, but you're still drawn to him. And I mean, that's the character, right? That's what we needed on screen. So as much as the original performance was great, it just wasn't going to be that same power, that same presence.
I always saw you remind me of the sensei from Karate Kid. And that's the way, I don't know if that's what you were looking for, but that's the way I took him, as the sensei from Karate Kid. So,
well, and I think he's definitely trying to, you know, like the scene where he's doing Tai Chi in front of the flag.
Yes.
I think he's, you know, and more explicitly, I told the son, like, you're a dude that grew up watching Rambo, Terminator, like you are modeling yourself after these action movies. And I think you can see that more explicitly in the son's performance. But I think in Grant, that quality is definitely there of like, yeah, he probably watched a bunch of stupid kung fu movies back in the day and just like, oh, sure, that's, you know, I'm not going to take a Tai Chi class. I'm not going to actually study yoga, but I'm going to say a couple weird things that I stole from a bad 60s movie. Like, you know, he's a man that's just this weird hodgepodge of affectations.
And the mother, the daughter, and the son, we've already told, where'd you find them?
So the mother was friends with, so I co-directed the play, and I met the mother through my co-director. And then the two kids were an open casting call. Like we had some older people, like 26, 27 year olds. They're like, this person could play the part, but it's on stage. It's going to be a little weird looking. So we just kind of put an open casting call out, and Emma Center, who plays Savannah, and Colby Rummel, who plays Kyle, they both just knocked it out of the park. Like I couldn't have asked more for their performances, and they're both excellent to work with. So, you know, it's the sort of thing where there's a couple options in the casting call. We're like, oh, that person's kind of good, and that person, we're not really sure. And we did a chemistry audition where we had Colby and Emma read together. And once we saw their dynamic, we're like, yeah, that's it. Like we just, these are the kids.
Now, when you finished the play, did they know there was going to be a film? Did you let them in ahead of time or no? That was totally after.
Well, there's discussion of maybe doing extensions. We were maybe going to do like three more shows at the same theater. But we had scheduling conflicts. So we couldn't make those happen. I don't remember what I think there was always talk of like, oh, let's do, but you know how it is with some of these creative projects where everyone's like, hey, we're going to be best friends after this and let's make five sequels. And you're never really sure what's actually going to substantiate. So, I don't remember exactly what we all said, but, you know, our last show was, I want to say June 28th. And I had a first draft of the movie script by mid July at worst the end of July. So, pretty quickly, and because you know we were shooting November, so pretty quickly I had the wheels in motion for production.
Well, I think we have to discuss your music for a bit because I love your music; it works all the time. I do love the ending song. I think it's my favorite song in the film. But let's go through the music. Help me out because a lot of different people wrote this stuff. I noticed.
Yeah, absolutely. So the main composer who also did the music for the play is Francois Comtois, the drummer of Young the Giant. And he's one of my oldest, closest friends, just great dude. And we have very similar musical tastes. So this is his first time composing a film. It was my first time directing a film. And just kind of, hey, let's just go on this crazy adventure together. But basically, I sent him over a playlist of all the music I'd been listening to. And then once I started like more intently watching old movies and trying to figure out what the tone is and all that stuff, I basically had a playlist of like Dylan, Neil Young, some more modern weird stuff like Godspeed You Black Emperor. Mm-hmm. I want to say TV on the Radio might've been on that, but just like taking just kind of a little bit darker, a little more abstract and just kind of modern, just kind of dissonance, and then fusing that into just classic rootsy Americana. Early 70s Stones, like Sticky Fingers, that was definitely up there as well. I kind of sent him all these ideas and then he just started sending me songs. I think even when we were on set, we had at least, I want to say three or four rough demos. So we had the editor on set who was already just kind of putting montages to music and trying to see how everything fit. But yeah, basically Francois had never scored a movie. So he just wrote a bunch of songs and then we figured out where we need more songs, then wrote to that, and then wrote all the transitions once we had a picture lock. But it was just kind of figuring out each other and figuring out the process together. But whole lot of fun.
How was the editing process then? Because, I mean, you must have shot more than what I saw.
Like, honestly, the editing process, we had the editor on site was basically assembling scenes as we were shooting. So we had an assembly cut we finished shooting in like November 25th. And we had an assembly cut by December 10th, December 15th, something pretty quick after that. So part of it just, it was an 11-day shoot. So I want to say there was maybe four scenes in total that just got entirely scrapped. And most scenes, you know, we would do maybe three takes, seven takes if it got really, you know, down in the weeds with it. So you know, there was a lot of material, and me and my editor had to sit down and spend a lot of long days just staring and going through scene after scene and redoing it. And, you know, we didn't get actually picture lock until early March. So, you know, it took a while. But yeah, I think just by virtue of having a limited amount of footage and also a very concrete idea of what we wanted from the get go, it was definitely a lot to learn. It was a difficult undertaking, but, yeah, I enjoyed it.
I do have to ask for Margaret. Is Margaret your mother, or who is Margaret?
Margaret's my grandmother.
Okay.
And she kind of inspired a lot of my political development growing up, and she was very involved herself. She helped run the Planned Parenthood up in Northern California, and she served as a mayor of her town. So she was always just, one of the beacons of political involvement and morality and, you know, good community spirit in my life. So yeah, I wanted to put this movie to her memory.
See, I told you I watched the credits. okay. Don't worry. We're going to go to fun questions and then we'll let everybody know where they can find your film. Don't worry. I haven't forgotten. First time on the show, I have to ask you your favorite film.
You know, I was actually just thinking about this today, and my stock answer for the longest time has been The Graduate. Is because I went through a phase in college, especially where I was watching it like a couple times a week. You know, I was watching
wow.
it so much that I would just like turn it on and then I could be in bed and just face the other way. And I knew exactly what was on screen. I knew everything that was happening. I knew every line. I knew every shot. So I love, love, love that movie, but I also haven't seen it a while. So I can't say 100% that's still my favorite movie, but that's been my stock answer for a while.
Nothing wrong with The Graduate. Stick to your stock answer.
I mean, it's,
your favorite meal on set.
This sounds silly. I was most satisfied if I could get like a handful of trail mix, some cold brew coffee, and then a cigarette.
That is the most unique answer I've ever had, just so you know. last question, since this being your first film, what advice do you have for indie filmmakers?
I mean, I would say just over-prepare, right? Like, you know, I listened to every interview with directors and just picked up weird things. Like I started saying, I'm forgetting right now. Whenever you're ready. I picked that up from Clint Eastwood just because I happened to hear a random interview where an actor was talking about working with Clint, right? Like I read the Robert Rodriguez book and that had gave me an idea of how to stage a certain scene. So I would say just over prepare, like read and listen to and just learn as much from past directors as you possibly can. And if you can worm your way into any set in any capacity whatsoever beforehand, that's really going to help you. Like if you can get in on your buddy's editing process and see what that looks like, if you can do lights for somebody, if you can just watch your friend direct, like just get as much experience as you can and educate yourself as much as you can, because you're never going to be totally prepared. But if you have a lot of answers, you're more likely to come up with the right answer when you need one.
And before we let you go, since you didn't want to go the virtual film festival route, where can people find your film?
So we're available on digital now. You can find us on the Apple Store, on Google Play Store, and Amazon. You can rent and buy us right now.
Thank you for your time, and have a great evening.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.